Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
episode one of The Way of Shangzhu by Thomas Merton. This is a philosophical text. I thought it was, I've been given the Chinese principles of war, but this is obviously very much different. And yes, so I assume, being thousands of years old, that this is out of copyright. And a note to the reader. So this is a little book of Chinese wisdom. I'm going to read it to you, and it's The Way of Shangzhu. The rather special nature of this book calls for some explanation. The text comes from Shangzhu, assembled here as a result of 5 years reading, studying, annotation, and meditation. The notes have in time acquired the shape of their own and have become as if it were imitations of Shangzhu, or rather free interpretive readings of the characteristic passages which appeal especially to me. These readings are of my own grew from comparison of 4 of the best translations of Shangzhu into Western languages, 2 English, 2 French, 1 German. In reading these translations, I found very notable differences and soon realized that all who have translated Shangzhu have had to do a great deal of guessing. Their guesses reflect not only the degree of Chinese scholarship, but their own grasp of the mysterious way described by the master writing in Asia 2,500 years ago. Since I only know a few Chinese characters, I obviously am not a translator. These readings are then not an attempt of a faithful reproduction, but ventures in personal spiritual interpretation. Inevitably, any rendering of Shangzhu is bound by personal, whatever it is. I think I've done 2 pages there. No, by to be very personal. Though, from the point of view of scholarship, I'm not even a dwarf sitting on the shoulders of these giants. And though not all my renderings can even be qualified as poetry, I believe that certain type of reader will enjoy my intuitive approach to the thinker who is subtle, funny, provocative, and not easily to get at all. I believe this is not blind faith, but those who have seen the material in manuscripts have given evidence of liking it and have encouraged me to make it a book out of it. Thus, though I do not think that this book calls for blame, if someone wants to be unpleasant about it, he can blame me and my friends, and especially Dr. John Wu, who is my chief arbiter and accomplice, who has been a great help in many ways. We're all in this together, and I may as well say that I've enjoyed writing this book more than any other I can remember. So I declare myself a bit obituary impertinent. My dealings with Shangzhu even have been most rewarding. John, as a theory that is in some form of life, I was a Chinese monk. John has a theory. I do not know about that, and of course I hasten to assure everyone I do not believe in reincarnation, and neither does he, but I have belief in the Chinese monk for nearly 25 years. With an inevitable one comes in time to see life from a viewpoint that has a common with the solitaries and recluses of all ages and all cultures. One may dispute the thesis of monasticism, Christian or non-Christian, is essentially one. I believe the Christian monasticism has obvious characteristics of its own. Nevertheless, there is a monastic outlook which is common to all those who have elected to question the value of life submitted entirely to arbitrary secular positions, dedicated by social convention and dedicated to the pursuit of temporal satisfactions which are perhaps only a mirage. Whatever be the value of life in the world, there have been in all cultures men who have claimed to find something they vastly prefer in solitude. St. Augustine once made a rather strong statement, which he later qualified, saying that which is called the Christian religion existed among the ancients and never did not exist from the beginning of the human race until Christ came to flesh. De vir originale, it certainly be an exaggeration to call Shangzhu a Christian, And it is not my intention to waste my time in speculation as to what his possible rudiments in theology might be discovered by his mysterious statements about Tao. This book is not intended to prove anything or to convince anyone of anything that he does not want to hear about in the first place. In other words, it's not an apologetic subtlety or indeed a work of Jesuitical sleight of hand in which Christian rabbits will be suddenly appear as magic out of the Taoist hat. Look, I don't know. I've read this Jesuit... I don't know. Reading Bernard Lonergan, which I might read. That's a very intense book, but that is very hard to. The Jesuit philosophers are pretty intense, as far as I'm concerned. I simply like Chuang Tzu because he is what he is, and I feel no need to justify this liking to myself or to anyone else. He is far too great to need any apologies from me. If St. Augustine could read Polonius, if St. Thomas could read Aristotle, and Averroes, both of them a long way further from Christianity than Chuang Tzu ever was, if Teilhard de Chardin could make copious use of Marx and Engels in his synthesis, I think I can be pardoned for consorting with Chinese recluse who shared the climate and peace of mind, my kind of mind of solitude, and to know who is my own kind of person. His philosophical temper is, I believe, profoundly original and sane. I can, of course, be misunderstood, but it is basically simple and direct. It seeks, as does all greatest philosophical thought, to go immediately to the heart of things. Tsing Shu is not concerned with words and formulas about reality, but with the direct existential grasp of reality itself. Such a grasp is necessarily obscure and does not itself... lend to abstract analysis. It can be presented as a parable, a fable, or as a funny story about a conversation between two philosophers. Not all stories are necessarily by Chuang Tzu himself. Indeed, some are about him. The Chuang Tzu book is a compilation in which some of the chapters are mostly certainly by the master himself, but many others, especially the latter ones, are by his disciples. The whole Chuang Tzu book is an anthology of thought, of humour, of gossip, and irony that were current in the Taoist circles in the best period, the 4th and 3rd centuries BC. But the whole teaching, the way contained in these anecdotes, poems and meditations, is characteristics of a certain mentality found everywhere in the world, a certain taste for simplicity, for humility, self-effacement, silence and general refusal to take seriously the aggressivity, the ambition, the push, self-importance which one must display in order to get along with society. This is the other way that prefers not to get anywhere in the world, nor even in the field of some supposedly spiritual attainment. The book of the Bible, which most obviously resembles the Taoist classics, is the Classices. Oh, I have to read that one. But at the same time, there is much in the teaching of the Gospels on simplicity, childlikeness, humility, and responds to the deepest aspiration of the Chuang Tzu book. And the Tao Te Ching, John Wu has pointed this out in a remarkable essay on St. Therese Lisieux and Taoism, presently to be published in a book together with his study of Chuang Tzu. Now, Ecclesiastes is a book of the earth, and the gospel ethic is an ethic of revelation made on earth by God incarnate. The Little Way of Therese of Lisieux is explicit renunciation of all exalted disincarnate spirituality that divide man against himself, putting one half of the realm of angels and the other half of earthly hell. For Chuang Tzu, as for the Gospel, to lose one's life is to save it, and to seek To save it for one's own sake is to lose it. That's amazing. There is an affirmation that the world isn't that. There's nothing but ruin and loss. There is an annunciation of the world. Oh, we're coming to the end of this. That finds and saves a man in his own home, which God's word. In any event, the way of Shang Tzu is mysterious because it's so simple that it can get along without being a way at all. At least, at all, it is a way out. Shang Tzu would agree with St. John of the Cross that you enter upon this kind of way when you leave always and, in some sense, get lost. Oh, so he's written from the Abbey Gethsemane, Pentecost. So that's why he's written the note. The study of Shang Tzu. The classic period of Chinese philosophy covers about 300 years, from 550 to 350 BC. Shang Tzu, the greatest Taoist writer whose historical existence can be verified, we cannot be sure of Lao Tzu, flourished towards the end of this period. And indeed, the last chapter of the Shang Tzu book, chapter 33, is a witty, informative history of Chinese philosophy up to this time, the first document of its kind, at least in the Orient. The humour, sophistication, literary genius, and the philosophical insight of Shang Tzu are evidence to anyone who samples his work. But before one can begin to understand even a little of this subtlety, one must situate him in the cultural historical context. That is to say that one must see him against the background of Confucianism, which he did not hesitate to ridicule, along with all other sedate and accepted school of Chinese thought. From Mao Tse to Cheng's contemporary friend, the constant opponent, the logician Hui Zhu, one also see him in relation to what followed him, because it would be a great mistake to confuse Taoism of Chang Tzu with the popular degenerate, oh dear, amalgam of superstition, alchemy, magic, and health culture, which Taoism later became. Oh, wow. The true inheritors of the thought of the spirit of Shang Tzu are the Chinese Zen Buddhists of the Chang period, 7th to 10th century AD. But Shang Tzu continued to exert influence over all cultured Chinese thought, since he never ceased to be recognized as one of the great writers and thinkers of the classical period. The subtle, sophisticated, mystical Taoism of Shang Tzu and Tao Tzu has left permanent marks on all Chinese culture and on the Chinese character itself. There have never been lagging authorities like Dazetsu Suzuki, the Japanese Zen scholar, who declared Shang Tzu to be the very greatest of Chinese philosophies. There is no question that the kind of thought and culture represented by Shang Tzu was what transformed highly speculative Indian Buddhism into the humorous, iconoclastic, and totally practical kind of Buddhism that flourished in China and Japan and various schools of Zen. Zen throws light on the Shang Tzu, and Shang Tzu throws lights on Zen. I don't know what Zen is. However, let us be on our guard. This reference to Zen, which naturally suggests itself at a time when Zen was still somewhat popular in the Western world, may be a clue. But it may also be a misleading cliché. While there are quite a few Western readers who have, in one way or another, heard about Zen or even tasted a little of it with the tip of their tongue, but tasting is one thing and swallowing is another. Especially when, having only tasted, one proceeds to identify the thing tasted with something else which seems to resemble. The fashion of Zen in certain Western circles fits into a rather confused pattern of spiritual revolution and renewal. It represents a certain understanding of dissatisfaction with conventional spiritual patterns, with the ethical and religious formalism. It is a symptom of Western man's desperate need to recover spontaneity, the depth in the world which his technological skills has made rich to artificial and spiritually void. But in its association With the need to recover authentic sense of experience, Western Zen has become identified with the spirit of improvisation and experimentation, with a sort of moral anarchy that forgets how much tough discipline that and what severe tradition mores are presupposed by Zen of China and Japan. Also, with Shangzhu, he might... Also, with Shangzhu, he might be easily to read today as one of the preaching gospel of license and control. Shangzhu himself would be the first to say you cannot tell people whatever to do, whatever they want, when they don't even know what they want in the first place. And then also we must realise that while there is a certain skeptical down-to-earth quality in Shangzhu's critique of Confucianism, Shang's philosophy is essentially religious and mystical. It belongs to the context of a society in which every aspect of life was seen in relation to the sacred. There is not much danger of confusing Shangzhu with Confucius or Mencius, whoever he is. But there is perhaps more difficulty in distinguishing him from the first sight from the example of sophists and hedonists of his own time. For example, Yang Chu resembles Shangzhu in his praise of reclusion and his contempt for politics. He bases a philosophy of evasion, which is frankly egotistical, on the principle that the bigger and the more valuable the tree is, the more likely it is to fall victim to the hurricane or to the lumberman's axe. The avoidance of political responsibility was, therefore, essential to Yang's idea of personal happiness. He carried this to such an extent that Mencius said of him, quote, thought he might have benefited the whole world by plucking out a single hair. He would not have done it. Whatever that means. However, even when Shangzhu hedonism can be found, we can find elements which remind us of our own modern concern with the person. For instance, the idea that life and integrity of the person remains greater value than any object that, or any function which the person may be called to devote himself at risk of alienation. But a personalism that is nothing to offer but evasion will not be a genuine personalism at all, since it destroys the relationship about which the person cannot truly develop. After all, the idea that one can seriously cultivate his own personal freedom merely by discarding inhibitors and obligations to live in self-centered spontaneity results in complete decay of the true self and capacity for freedom. Wow. He's got an idea in his head. Personalism and individualism must not be confused. Personalism gives priority to the person and not to the individual himself. To give priority to a person means respecting the unique inalienable value of another person as well as another's and one's own. For respect that is centered only on the individual self to the exclusion of others proves itself to be fraudulent. The classic Zhu philosophy of Confucius and his followers can be called a traditional personalism built on the basic social relationships and obligations that are essential to human life, and that, carried out as they should be, develop the human personalities of each person in relation to others. In fulfilling commands of nature, as manifest by tradition, which are essentially commands of love, man develops his own inner personal potential for love, understanding, reverence, and wisdom. He becomes a, quote, superior man, end quote, or a, quote, noble-minded man, fully in harmony with heaven, earth, his sovereign, his parents and children, his fellow men, by his obedience to Tao. The character of superior man or noble-minded man, according to Zhu philosophy, is constructed around a four-sided mandala of basic virtues. The first of these, compassionate and devoted love, discharged with deep empathy and sincerity. How can you discharge? That doesn't make sense to me. If you decide to be sincere, insincere. That enables one to identify with the troubles and joys of others if they are one's own. The compassion is called Zen and is sometimes translated as human heartedness. The second of the basic virtues is that of justice, responsibility, duty, obligation, and the other called Yi. It reminds me of Bionicles a bit. It must be observed that Zhuang philosophy insists on both Zhen and Yi are completely disinterested. The mark of a noble-minded man is that he does not do things simply because they are pleasing or profitable to him, but because they flow from an unconditional moral imperative. They are things that he sees to be right and good in themselves. Hence, anyone who is guided by a profit motive, even though it be for a profit for society to which he belongs, is not capable of living a genuine moral life. Even if he acts not to conflict with the moral law, they remain amoral because they are motivated by the desire to profit and not the love of good. The other two basic virtues of Zhu are the necessary to complete this picture is the wholeness and humanness. Li sometimes is more than exterior ritual correctness, is the ability to make use of ritual forms to give full outward expressions to the love and obligation by which one is bound to others. Li is acting out of veneration and love, not for parents, for one's sovereigns, for one's people, but also for the heaven and earth. It's liturgical contemplation of the religious and metaphysical structure of the person and the family, society and cosmos itself. The ancient Chinese liturgists made observations for all the movements under the sky, directing their attention to the interpenetrations which take place in them. This with a view to putting into effect right rituals. I don't quite understand that. One's individual self should be lost in the ritual disposition in which one emerges as a higher liturgical self, animated by compassion and respect, which have traditionally informed the deepest represses responses of one's family and people's presence of heaven, quote, Qian, or Qian Minskaya, Qian. One learns that by Li to take one's place gratefully in the cosmos and history. Finally, there is wisdom, Qi, that embraces all the other virtues in mature and religious understanding, orients themselves in living fulfillment. This really reminds me of the four levels, like Aristotle had a fourth, always had one level above. He had earth, fire, what is it? Earth, fire, water, air. Earth, fire, water, and ether. Okay. Saint Augustine quote, love and do what you will, but Confucius did not claim to have reached this point until he was 70. In any case, the man who has attained qi, or wisdom, has learned spontaneous inner obedience to heaven, and is no longer governed merely by external standards, but a long and arduous discipline by external standards remains absolutely necessary. The sound and humane ideals, admirable in themselves, were socially implemented by a structure of duties, rights, and observances. That would, my God, Father keeps on going. How far does this go for? I'm reading this up, guys and girls. I don't think any girl would possibly listen to this. Oh dear. It's actually probably worth reading through it, but it's going to take a while. I'm going to stop at page 8. Seems to us extraordinary and complex and artificial. And when Chao Tzu, making fun of Confucius' practices of Li, for example, the rites of mourning, we must not interpret him in the light of our own extremely casual mores, empty of symbolic feeling and insensitive to persuasion of ceremony. We must remember that we ourselves are living in a society which is almost unimaginably different from the Middle Kingdom of 300 BC. We might perhaps find an analogy with our own way of life in Imperial Rome, if not Carthage, Niv, or Babylon. Though China of the 4th century was not without its barbarities, it will probably be more refined, more complex, and more humane than these cities that the Apocalypse of John portrayed as the typical world of brutality, greed, and power. The climate of Chinese thought was certainly affected by the fact that Zhu ideal was taken seriously and was really, to some extent, built in by education and liturgy in the structure of Chinese society. We must, however, imagine anachronistically that in the time of Chiang Tzu, the Chinese governing class was systematically educated en masse according to Confucian principles, as happened later. So it didn't happen then. If Chiang Tzu reacted against the Zhu doctrine, it was not in the name of something lower, the animal spontaneity of the individual who does not want to be bothered with a lot of the tiresome duties, but in the name of something altogether higher. This is the most important factor to remember when Westerners confront the seemingly antinomianism of Chiang Tzu and the Zen masters. Chiang Tzu was not demanding less than Zheng Ji, but more. His chief complaint was it did not go far enough. It produced well-behaved, virtuous officials, indeed cultured men, but it nevertheless limited and imprisoned them within fixed external norms and consequently made it impossible for them to act freely and creatively in response to the ever-new demands of the unforeseen situations. Zhu philosophy also appealed to Tao, as did Chiang Tzu. In fact, all Chinese philosophy and Chinese culture tend to be Taoist in a broad sense, since the idea of Tao is, in one form or another, central to the traditional Chinese thinking. Confucius could speak of my Tao. He could demand that a disciple set his heart on the Tao. He could declare, if a man hears the Tao in the morning and dies in the evening, his life has not been wasted. He could add that if a man reaches the age of 40 or 50 without ever hearing the Tao, there is nothing worthy to respect in him. Yet Chiang Tzu believed that the Tao on which Confucius set his heart was not the great Tao that is invisible and incomprehensible. It was the lesser reflection of Tao that manifests itself in human life. It was the traditional wisdom that the Tao that handed down by the ancients, the guide of practical life, the way of virtue. The first chapter of Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu's, distinguishes between eternal Tao that cannot be named with the nameless and unknowable source of all being, and the Tao that can be named, which is the mother of all things. Confucius may have had access to the manifest aspects of Tao that can be named, but the basis of all Chiang Tao's critique of Zhu philosophy is never comes from near to the Tao that cannot be named, and indeed takes no account of it. Until relatively late works like the Doctrine of the Mean, which is influenced by Taoism, Confucius refused to concern himself with the Tao higher than that of a man precisely because it is unknowable and because the reach of rational discourse. Chiang Tzu held that only when one was in contact with the mysterious Tao, which is beyond all existent things, which cannot be conveyed neither by words or by silence, which is apprehended only in a state which is neither speech nor silence, could one really understand how to live. To live merely according to the Tao of man was to go astray. The Tao of Jewel of philosophy, in the words of Confucius, threading together into one the desires of self and the desires of others. This can therefore be called the ethical Tao, or the Tao of man. the manifestation in the act and the principle of love and justice, is identifiable with the golden rule, quote, treating others as one would be treated oneself. But it is not the Tao of heaven. In fact, Confucianism developed. It continued to divide, subdivide the idea of Tao until it became simply a term indicating an abstract universal principle in the realm of ethics. Thus we hear of the Tao of fatherhood, the Tao of sonship, the Tao of wifeness, the Tao of ministership, the Tao of motor mechanics. Nevertheless, when Confucianism thought was deeply influenced by Taoism, the various human Taos could and did become fingers pointed towards the invisible divine Tao. This is clear for the instance of Tao of paintings. Throughout the course of Chinese painting, the common purpose has been to reaffirm the traditional human Tao and to transmit the ideas, principles, and methods that have been tested and developed by the masters of each period as the means of expressing and harmony of Tao. Shang Tzu dryly observed that the pursuits of other ethical Taos becomes illusory if one sought for others what was good for oneself without really knowing what was good for oneself. He takes up the question of good in relation to good in meditation, and I have called perfect joy. First of all, he denies that happiness can be found by hedonism and utilitarianism, the profit motive of Mo-Ti. The life of riches, ambition, and pleasure is a reality of intolerable servitude in which one, quote, lives for what is always out of reach, thirsting for survival in the future, and capable of living in the present. The Zhou philosopher would have no difficulty in agreeing that the motive of profit or pleasure is unworthy of a true man. But then Chong Tzu immediately, my godfather, let me keep on reading this, immediately turned against Zhu and criticizes the heroic and self-sacrificing public servants, the superior man of virtue informed by the school of Confucius. His analysis of the ambiguities of such life may perhaps seem subtle to us, living as we do, such as different moral climate. Chang Tzu, concerned with the problem that the very goodness of the good and the nobility of the great man contained the hidden seed of ruin, is analogous to the concern that Sophocles or Aeschylus felt a little earlier in the West. Chang Tzu comes up with a different answer in which there is less religious mystery. To put it simply, the hero, by virtue of duty, ultimately lands himself in the same ambiguities as the hiddenness and the utilitarian. Why? Because he aims at achieving the good as object. He engages in self-conscious and deliberate campaign to do his duty, in the belief that this is right and therefore productive in happiness. He sees happiness and the good as something to be attained, and thus he places them outside himself in a world of objects. In so doing, he becomes involved in the division from which there is no escape between the present, in which he is not yet in possession of what he needs, and the future, in which he thinks he will have what he desires. Between the wrong and the evil, absence of what he seeks, the good that he hopes to make present, his efforts to eliminate the evils, between his own ideas of right and wrong, and the contrary idea of right and wrong held by some other philosophical school, and so on. Shang Tzu does not allow himself to get engaged in the division of taking sides. On the contrary, he feels that the trouble is not merely that it means to Zhou philosophers with the means that Zhou philosophers choose to stand the ends, but the ends themselves. He believes that the concept of happiness and unhappiness is ambiguous from the start, since it is situated in the world of objects. This is no less true for more refined concepts of virtue, justice, and so on. In fact, it is especially true of good and evil, right and wrong. From the moment they are treated as objects to be attained, these values lead to delusion and alienation. Therefore, Shang Tzu agrees with the paradox of Tao Tzu, quote, when all the world recognizes good as good, it becomes evil. because it becomes something that one does not have, which one must constantly be pursuing until, in effect, it becomes unattainable. The more one seeks, quote, the good outside of oneself as something to be acquired, the more one is faced with the necessity of discussing, studying, understanding, analyzing the nature of good. The more, therefore, one becomes involved in the abstractions and the confusion of divergent opinions, the more, quote, the good is objectively analyzed, the more it is treated as something to be attained by specifically virtuous techniques, and less real it becomes. As it becomes less real, it recedes further into the distance of abstractions, futurity and unattainability. The more, therefore, one concentrates on the means to be used to attain it, and as its ends become more remote and more difficult, the means becomes more elaborate and complex, until finally the mere study of the means becomes so demanding that all one's effort must be concentrated on this, and the ends is forgotten. Hence, the nobility of the Jewish scholar becomes in reality a devotion to systematic, useless, practicing means which lead nowhere. This is, in fact, nothing but organized despair. The good that is preached and exalted by the moralist thus finally becomes evil, and all the more so since the hopeless pursuit of it distracts one from the real good, which one already possesses, and which we know, which one now despises and ignores. I'm going to break there for a while because it's a tough reading, mate. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.